Okay.
Daniel Moroz, what a surprise to see you. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Paul. How are
Yeah.
you?
Yeah, great. We're laughing because we just had 20 minutes of a fantastic conversation, but the internet kept dropping out, the connection kept dropping out. So we're hoping, fingers crossed, that this time the internet won't let us down, because we need the internet in this time of lockdown more than we ever have. So, Daniel Moroz, I'm sharing the screen. I'm sharing his website, thedancingword.org or dancingword.org. And if you look on this website, you see an astonishing CV of a theatre director who has a brilliant martial arts CV. I mean, like, and this is a copy of his, this is the cover of his book, The Dancing Word, An Embodied Approach to the Preparation of Performers and the Composition of Performances. So, hello again, Daniel.
Hi, Paul.
Fingers crossed, and touch wood, eh? Touch wood.
Yes, exactly.
So, what were we talking about? We were talking about, we were talking about the relationship between theatre performance and theatre training and actor training as well, I guess, and martial arts. And you've had a very long intertwined history of martial arts and theatre performance. Could you just let us know a little bit about your origin story? Tell us your origin story.
Well, there was this radioactive, no. I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to learn how to write dialogue. I wound up in theater. I'd been a classical music kid, and so I was used to really clear procedures, and theater in North America, especially in English, is taught with all sorts of just kind of weird role playing. You know, you got to pretend you're having the things that are going on in the fiction that you're portraying happen to you, and that's supposed to be acting. And so I was like really dissatisfied by this because it's not very effective. It presupposes everything's happening in the performer, and of course you want the stuff to happen in the audience. And sort of the heritage of Lee Strasberg and method acting and the popularization of the weirdness of actors by the media, you know, like Anthony Hopkins is not interesting when he says, "What did you know? What do you do to learn to prepare for the role?" And he's like, "I learned the lines," and no one cares. And Daniel Day-Lewis goes, you know, kind of batshit crazy when he gets into a new character, and everyone loves that. So, of course, this isn't a very satisfying thing for someone who's, you know, played violin and piano. It's like, how do you do stuff? There are incremental procedures. And so during my periods of frustration, I encountered an extraordinary theater director who came from this sort of more contemporary and more European physical theater tradition, which kind of combined dance and theater. The director's name was Richard Fowler, and he had been teaching at our National Theater School and had made performances with young people who he'd trained. And I got to see this in Montreal, which was a really a wonderful place to go to school, because it was just there was sort of, you know, more artists per square inch than anywhere else in Canada. And so my fascination with this kind of amazing physical, musical, very imagistic and metaphorical theater that he was making led me to write to that company, which was called Primus Theater. And I said, basically, how did you do that? You know, it was a very naive 20-year-old letter. And they said, well, if you'd like to come and sort of partake of this apprenticeship workshop, we'll show you. And that was the beginning of both my really practical training in theater, and also my exposure to martial arts, because shortly after working with this ensemble, it was 3 weeks every day, like 9 to 6. And, you know, I was a very conceptual, long-haired person who, you know, I wanted to read about Michel Foucault and drink coffee. And so having to do all this physical training was very alien. And after 3 weeks, I had no independence. And I asked Richard, how would I continue? And he said, well, the martial arts are a wonderful way of studying stage presence, because stage presence is sort of your ability to hold obvious or subtle potential energy. We'll always watch someone who's about to do something.
Okay.
So you think of watching a cat, right? Like they almost never pounce, but they spend hours and hours and hours practicing pouncing. And our mammal's eye is always like drawn. We're going to watch the potential energy.
So do you think that there's theatricality in all martial arts? I mean, are we learning, when we learn martial arts, are we learning something to do with acting, or is it to do with presence and performing, or what would you say?
I think both of those things are present, and it's a contextual conversation to see which one we're talking about. When I came to Cardiff and did that presentation with everyone, there are clear moments in the Chinese martial arts where you have in a Taolu, in the choreographic training methods, you see actual representation, and it's a clear, this is a character from folklore and mythology and religion, and we're going to be demonstrating that.
Yeah,
this is
Scott Phillips' kind of line, isn't it? Like Scott Park Phillips thinks that if you look at Chen style Tai Chi, it's essentially kind of theatrical performance of classical or traditional themes.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to steal Scott's thing, because that's definitely his thing. But you know, the Guan Dao, which is this giant glaive, right? It's a big spoon-shaped or half-moon-shaped blade on a staff. This is the weapon associated with a particular folk hero and a deity. And you know, when you're performing all of the drills that you're supposed to do with that in the choreographed fashion, there are moments where you know you stop and actually have a little pause where you're holding the shape of that character as though you were playing Chinese opera, Chinese traditional theater. It's really, really clear. So that part, obvious. Mm-hmm. The second part of it where you said, you know,
he's fallen out. You've fallen out a second. The connection.
Ideally, you're manifesting presence.
You froze for a second. You manifested some frozen presence. So could you just say the second part of that again?
Wonderful. Yeah. I think I'm making a case for obvious theatricality, and then what this is often we wonder, because we are not initiated necessarily into what the meaning of all the physical actions are as observers, but we should see someone performing a whole bunch of very powerful, incredible actions when we watch a martial art demonstration.
Do you think that, I think you've frozen again, so this would be an ideal time to interrupt. And you're back.
Hey.
Do you think that different martial arts teach different kind of theatrical modes or different ways of behaving? So, I mean, I think, for example, there's a kind of an attitude that is encouraged in, say, Tai Chi performance, and there's an attitude encouraged when I learned Eskrima. It was very, very aggressive, and you had to be like you had to appear like really ferocious, and all your energy always forward thinking. So do you think that different, and some may be playful, some are trickster, like you have the whole capoeira thing, whereas deception, and so do you think that you learn different particular skills in particular martial arts, or?
For sure. I think we could also say there's like cultures of particular groups, and also I asked a teacher of mine at some point, like, you know, talk to me about martial arts technique and the development of it. And you know, I had this very overthought question. He said, well, there's only one technique. Surprise. Everything else, is attempting to engineer surprise. So okay. From that perspective, surprise with a blade could be achieved in multiple ways.
Yeah.
With surprise with foot fighting, like in capoeira, surprise in the you've been regretting not playing jiu-jitsu right now.
Yes.
So there's how surprise is delivered. Mm-hmm. I think we might say there's a whole bunch of different modes of behavior.
Okay.
That delivers surprise. And then there's culture, right? Like all the guys at my BJJ gym that I used to go to, they walk like apes, there's a certain relaxed kind of heavy, oh, hey man, what's up? And very informal. People in Chinese martial arts often act like they're trapped in a Shaw Brothers movie.
Yes.
Capoeira never starts on time. You know, there's a whole bunch. Those are
stereotypes.
Yeah, and I'm overdoing it a bit,
yeah.
But like that's group culture that I think is a bit different than how the surprise is delivered.
Okay, there's something like, that I really want to mention because you've said mm-hmm. a lot of things to me over email or face to face that are very, very thought provoking, and one of the things that sticks with me is something that was mentioned. This was ages ago in a conversation about something else. And you just said, in internal martial arts, like Tai Chi, like when we do push hands in Tai Chi, yeah. It's like a really, really intimate conversation where you're listening so intently to what mm-hmm. your partner is saying. But when we do external martial arts and we're battering each other, when we're shouting at each other, we're not listening to the other person, we're just mm-hmm. shouting them down. And mm-hmm. that stayed with me because it actually reflects what both very external, very physical instructors have said, like I don't care what you're doing, I'm doing this, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to mm-hmm. win. Whereas in Tai Chi and push hands, it's like, listen, stick, yield, neutralize, these kinds mm-hmm. of things. So, I mean, how far down does that go? Is there a strict line between an internal conversation and an external style conversation or not?
I wonder if I would not... Given what we just said about like different kinds of cultures versus different kinds of ways of creating surprise, I wonder if I wouldn't revise my thought about that.
Okay.
Because I have met people who ostensibly do Tai Chi and they're, there is no moment of negotiation. You're just yes. crushed. And similarly, yeah. I have met extremely, sort of sensitive boxers who let you tie yourself up in a mess and then, tap you from an angle that you didn't think you could be reached. So perhaps, I think there's also another element though is, yeah, I'll do this. I thought, like in human interactions, like you can usually chop them into, we're attracted to something, we dislike it, or we're indifferent. Mm-hmm. And if we look at martial arts as being a way of, making little embodied games of those three larger situations, we've got avoidance, where someone's trying to hit us and we don't want to be hit. Mm-hmm. And we've got the kind of the attraction one is entanglement, where I'm going to accept to roll around on the ground with you and try and outwit you, and you'll try and outwit me, but I'm accepting the attracted situation. I'm not trying to avoid it. And then there's a third one that from the perspective of performing arts, we don't use much, but I think, and is like fetishized in some martial arts, and it's absorption. So all that, being able to take hits, a lot of stuff that kind of might even be circus in a way, because it's an illusion, or that is the manifestation of like just, a huge skill differential. If I punch my good friend who's really a boxer, he doesn't care, right? It just goes in. He's already able to turn. He won't let me hit him to his face. There's just this kind of, and that's it. So the attraction, aversion, and indifference manifests as avoidance, which is striking, entanglement, which is grappling, and this absorption thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like how those are privileged or prioritized kind of determines the structure of your martial art. I met my experience is pretty parochial to Chinese martial arts, but, you know, I've met very soft people who play hunga, you know, hunkun. Yeah. And like that's supposed to be super hard and really lots of isometric training, and they look a bit rigid, but they didn't feel that way at all. And constantly, you know, I've met people who do taiji who just crush. So the I feel like there's ways in which the conversation can be understood within the art.
Okay, I mean, and do you think this is? And what kind of tropes and concepts and metaphors do you use to distinguish different kinds of martial practice, or maybe different kinds of physical practice in general? Because I think, you know, when I was talking to Ben Spatz, who we met the other day, he was talking about capture. Like, how do you capture? How do you conceptualize? How do you record? You know, what senses can be captured? And I think that the way in which we conceptualize things, you know, there's the traditional internal versus external thing, which can be mapped onto lots of different practice. And then, I mean, what are the, you know, do you have a good concept? Like, do you have a preferred set of metaphors and concepts for thinking about your practice?
I start off with a negative. I don't have I kind of don't. The one that you evoke, internal versus external, is disastrously bad because no one means the same thing by it.
Yeah.
The particular Taiji teacher who I'm apprenticed with has this incredibly particular definition for what that means. It is not shared by others. Mm-hmm. And so the categorization is seriously unhelpful. My own metaphors, I was starting to share them with you. I suppose that, you know, that there are, as soon as you have, you know, there are things that we want to do to prepare ourselves to experience, on the one hand, this energy and power efficiency. Mm-hmm. Two variables, and those can be done sort of by yourself. And hopefully you're also going to experience a kind of emptiness, that you're manipulating your body without these like ticks of desire, like my hand always wants to come in, or that I can actually run my arms with the big muscles on my back, and then with less and less and less preoccupation with how it's working, and I can zoom out on the whole experience. So my body is then sort of like a puppet. It's moving without this kind of clutching an inward intent. Mm-hmm. As soon as we then start to interact with people, we have this attraction, aversion, and indifference. And so we play different games.
Mm-hmm.
We play games of avoidance. We play games of entanglement. Certainly in what I'm doing with performing artists and most martial artists, we're not playing that much absorption. But those games allow us to see, you know, can I stay, you know, empty and receptive,
mm-hmm.
without, you know, while having the need to avoid or the need to be entangled. And I mean that, like, this sort of empty thing, it sounds very, it sounds a bit too esoteric, but if you externalize your decision-making process as a martial artist, you're going to be faster. Like, if I ask you, Paul, move your hand as fast as you can, and you'll do something. Yeah, exactly.
Want me to do it again?
It's incredible. The other thing that I can do is, like, Paul, I'm going to chuck this metal ball at you,
yeah,
and you'll be way faster because it's come from outside of you. And you don't want to be hit by the metal ball. Similarly, when you're performing on stage, if you're neurotic and self-involved, you can have all these weird time lags in your performance that will make the audience find you not credible. You'll be like a high school play. And if you are empty of intent and you are only responding to what other people are giving you, you will be in wonderful timing. You'll have plenty of mental space to be spontaneous, to change your timing a little bit, to adjust with them, to think of things you hadn't thought of before if you're making the performance, and to do the performance with a slightly different quality based on that moment once you're actually, you know, in performance compared to rehearsal, the performance. So this externalizing of intent, of giving it to somebody else, is like, I think it's really concrete. So when we use words that, you know, have come to us coded through the 60s and 70s and Alan Watts and all that stuff.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. You know, but it's just like, oh, he's nattering on about emptiness. What the hell is that? You know, it's like, no, you've got to, you know, if you're self-involved, you can't be in time with someone else. If your job is to make something interesting in the imagination of an audience by being in time with someone else, you better not be self-involved. So martial arts are a wonderful way of experiencing that.
Okay.
One of the most direct ways.
Yeah. So you've said there's too much to unpack there. So I want to move. Don't spit on your computer. No.
All right. That's enough.
So there's two. I want to share another screen. Okay.
Because I want to
cover. There are some things I want to cover. I know I said, oh, we're just going to talk about, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So this article, you can see that screen now, yeah. So it's the front page of your article that was published in one of the first couple of issues of issue 3, there's the citation down there, of martial arts studies. And this was the written up text of your keynote that you gave in 2016. Yeah. And it's Tao Lu, Credibility and Decipherability in the Practice of Chinese Martial Movement. Now, I want to ask you a question about this that will put you on the spot, and you can politely and diplomatically step aside from it if you want. But if you if you've read, you can side, you can avoid it, or you can absorb it, or you can, you know. So this article followed on from, not didn't follow on it historically. It followed on from an article written by D.S. Farah, Doug Farah, who wrote an article in the first issue of the journal, which was called Efficacy or Efficiency and Entertainment in Martial Arts. And Farah proposes a binary for martial arts. And he said there's efficiency, there's the desire to do a job, like, you know, and then there's entertainment. And I thought that's interesting, but it troubled me, the binary troubled me. His article does more than just operate within that binary, but he does pull things back to it. And then a couple of issues later, you produce another binary, which is credibility and decipherability. And I've thought about both of these articles and both of these binaries together, and I've written about them and given talks, because they're entangled, these two articles and these two sets of binaries. And I think there's something in Farah's argument that, yeah, there's a binary between efficiency and entertainment. So, you know, if we do wushu, or if we're doing tai chi, there is some efficiency there, but I always loved the theatricality of Chinese kung fu. When I did Choi Li Foot, it was the physical beauty of it that totally it had me. But you argue about that, you tie that into a different binary that is a slight displacement of Farah's terms. You've got credibility, which is, I guess, is it believable? Is it plausible? Is this fighty? Is this efficient? And then decipherability, which to me is kind of connected to Farah's entertainment. But if I had to choose the two binaries, I've always chosen yours. I mean, you can speak to that. You can be diplomatic. You can.
Yeah. That's super funny. When I was making some notes here, I was thinking about Doug's article, and here's how it came up. So if I try and steer through this. So I mentioned this in the conversation that was interrupted by the bad internet that we experienced earlier, where I feel like Chinese martial arts is this stub of Chinese religion. And so if you imagine medicine and theater and martial arts are these stones in a river, and the river is Chinese popular religion, and someone comes along, takes the river away, and then we forget about even the possibilities of rivers, so we can't even say, oh, these three things are river stones, and we just wonder, what are these stones? And so all of the unusual displays and activities in Chinese martial arts, particularly the practice of Taolu, which don't seem directly related to fighting, become a bit weird, and we have to come up with a whole bunch of, you know, after the fact justifications for their existence. But and this is, I'm going to digress a little bit, so I hope that you will be patient with me. Yes. There's a wonderful book by a scholar who's a friend of mine named Ian Baker, and Ian Baker has written a book about Tibetan yoga, which is an unknown practice basically in the West. Now you can start to see, and even in Asia, but there's some video archive of it now. But what he says in this scholarly book on Tibetan yoga is that Tibetan Buddhism, as received, is a system that is composed of ritual magic and scriptural study. But there was a whole bunch of physical activities, or psychophysical activities, to use contemporary jargon, that produced the insights in the first place. And those were never really shared. So you get this weird mix of, you know, different types of religious activities without the practice that gave the initial insights. So I would suggest that Chinese martial arts training, like the Taolu, the conditioning, the repetition, this durational, immersive practice, is the embodied activity that produces the insights of Chinese religion. And so if you put back the river flowing over those river stones, then you're not having... Paul, can you still hear me?
Yeah, dude, it's good. I'm sorry, I'm just thinking, listening, thinking.
Sorry, I've lost my ability to find your picture amidst all my screens here. So if we put back the river of Chinese religion, you know, even like we can't put it actually back because that time is over. But if we put it back, we get everything. Okay. You can have something that is absolutely to deal with local and even, you know, state level violence. Mm-hmm. You can have something that is, you know, absolutely about a kind of entertaining religious performance. A way of looking at the demonstration of Taolu is it's an act of self-consecration. Mm-hmm. And the people doing it are experiencing the emptiness that we discovered or discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. And the people watching it are like, oh yes, great, this person is building up merit for our community by performing Kung Fu in our seasonal calendar of festivals. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think these binaries are not, you don't have to decide, they're not one or the other. Mm-hmm. They depend on realizing that this comes out of Chinese religion. And one of the signs of the practice of Chinese religion, which is really this North Asian not knowing, like Swowang, sitting and forgetting. Mm-hmm. So what comes out of the not knowing and the emptiness is a series of reversals. And there's a wonderful book by Taoist scholar Isabelle Robinet called Le Monde à l'envers, The World Upside Down. Mm-hmm. And it is all about these practices of what's called Jindan, golden elixir, or mm-hmm. Neidan, internal elixir, which are a series of reversals. And, you know, for us, sort of people trained in the humanities in the West, we would think of, you know, the reversals of the Carnivalesque. Mm-hmm. Would be a kind of a correlate. Okay. And yes, yeah, so when I look at these binaries, like Doug's or mine, they're there, and they kind of coexist. And you can look, depending on what perspective you're taking, mm-hmm. they will be useful at that time. But they're like complementary opposites in a Chinese way, like yin yang, like the originally from the sunny and the shady side of a mountain. Like if you don't have a mountain, then you can't have a sunny and a shady side. Mm-hmm. Night doesn't make much sense without day. So these aren't these sort of problematic oppositions like Descartes and the mind and the body. They aren't things that like, oh God, we need to think about this forever to try and resolve it and realize we've made a mistake. They're just complementary opposites that seem very pragmatic at the time. There's day, there's night, there's waking, there's sleeping. Mm-hmm. Maybe they interfere with each other. How do they relate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that would be my long answer.
No, it's that's a great answer. I really like the fact that, you know, without the sunny, without the mountain, there is no sort of sunny side and shady side, because it relates to, you know, the complex question of, say, comparison in comparative literature. Like, you know, you always need a third term, and that third term is either this kind of silenced or excluded kind of middle, or the arbiter of the two terms. Mm-hmm. And then an elementary deconstructive operation is to go, yeah, but who set up this goddamn binary in the first place, and for what for what purposes? And that displaces you away from thinking about the binary to kind of think, well, who does this serve, and why is it there? Yeah, and then, well, I mean, I think you nailed it even more concisely with that. If there isn't a mountain to have a sunny side and a shady side, then there isn't, and yeah, there just isn't anything. So yeah. So I guess is it a lifelong relation that you have, like in terms of your career? I know that in terms of your life, in terms of your daily life, your martial practice and your Qigong and healthful practice, it's what you do. It's always there. But in terms of your career, in terms of your professional life, is it always there? Will you always be thinking about martial arts and maybe writing about them and working with them in theater practice?
I would answer that in two ways. The having a desk job, which is basically what being a professor is, even if you teach a lot of studio classes, it's really a great challenge to remain competent as a martial artist when all the pressure in your professional life is sit at a computer. So to all my colleagues who have managed to figure that one out, I'm incredibly impressed, because it is a daily struggle or a daily challenge, practice, to realize that a lot of the insight that I can have or that one can have is dependent on practice, and that must be maintained. And unfortunately, the word I just used, maintained, is often all you can do. And so I crave these moments where there's space for a kind of intensity that allows you to go beyond maintenance, mm-hmm. and to learn new things and to refine. Professionally speaking, like, I would really like to write another book, which would cover kind of the yin, if you will. A friend of mine just suggested this to me, that the first book I wrote was very much about very concrete procedures and very visible, doable things. And the second one is more about directing and choreography and sort of how to see what isn't there. Mm-hmm. And what are all the strategies of manipulating space and time, or realizing what is present in space and time, in order to, again, have this kind of artistic manifestation, if you will, of this, what I was talking about earlier, the golden elixir, where art is engaging for us because it presents things in a way that is different from what we took for granted. And so I feel like the transfer from a martial practice to a very formal artistic practice is the correlate of that, are these, you know, making works of art that wake people up or offer a different viewpoint that is either, you know, surprising or delightful or horrific, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. They people can engage differently with the world and with themselves. So yeah, I'd like to work on that. And there's a professionally speaking, that is like, I don't know where it goes, because there's a big part of what little I know about Chinese normative religion that informs it. There's an awful lot of trying to explain strange phenomenological experiences that we have as martial arts people. And, you know, do you go into your own subjective language? Do you try and see what kinesiology and cognitive neuroscience have figured out and figure out what those correlates are, which is sort of like, do you give yourself another PhD part-time in order to be able to write competently in that way? And then do you go into the operative jargon of performing arts, which can often be wonderful and evocative, but also can often be really imprecise. So right now I'm sort of trying to figure out what the gate of entry is for organizing all that material.
Okay. So at the start of your answer, you talked about the amount of time, and you maybe you feel like you've just got to maintain. But mm-hmm. I mean, this is an abiding concern of mine. It's an abiding question, right? And this is I think about this a lot, right? Like, how much time does it take? Because, so again, actually, I was with D.S. Farah, and we were at a conference, and we were talking, and he said, I mean, he's been obsessed with martial arts since he was a child, and he you know him as well as I do, and he has a great deal of expertise in a very wide range of systems, and he said that he's essentially distilled all of his different lessons and all of the things that he feels he needs to know down into a very compact practice, and he said he might give himself 2 hours a day. Maybe an hour of that will be something martial, and the other hour might be yoga, and he's distilled it down. And it reminds me of Bruce Lee talking about, it's not about daily addition, it's daily reduction. And when I do my Tai Chi or Qigong practice, it's less and less. I do less and less. I don't learn more forms. I only know, you know, one long form, one short form, one very short form, and Bai Duan Jin and some standing Qigong. You don't want to do more. You do it deeper. But also, I wonder, like, what's the minimal and most efficient amount of training that you could do? So when I started to do Eskrima a good long number of years ago now, and I realized that my basic boxing punches left a lot to be desired. And I wasn't doing them efficiently or effectively or anything. And what I started to do every day was, in addition to my Tai Chi, I would just do jab, cross, hook, uppercut, back fist, really slowly, like Tai Chi, really relaxed, but actually perfect. And my punching and kicking went, and I would do some kicks as well, really slowly, like Tai Chi. And my skill level went through the roof, and I was only doing an extra 5-10 minutes a day drilling like this. So we might have desk jobs. We might be professors now. We might be getting old. We are. But can't we still improve don't we learn how to improve? Don't we learn how to train better?
Yeah. I think you're quite right. I had the strange paradoxical experience of feeling like I move much better than I used to. Nevertheless, I'm also carrying way more limitations. You know, yeah. I blew my Achilles tendon a while ago, and like, so everything on one side of my body is a little bit terrified of that happening again, and is not quite, you know, I have to reprogram certain things constantly to remain level. There's a lot of truth in reducing and simplifying. I think it also depends on what's your situation. If you want to hold responsibility for like a particular curriculum and then be able to reteach that, then you're stuck practicing that curriculum, even if it's way more than one person actually needs. And the other part, I think, is that unless you've had the most incredible upbringing where you were active in the martial arts your whole youth, like maybe up to your mid-30s, going down to one or two things may mean that there's just not enough sophistication in your movement. So I'm a bit of a middle ground kind of person. Like when I was doing Chaux de Foot, I think I knew 23 sets. Now there's two open hand sets in the Chen Taiji. There's a whole bunch. I love the straight sword, so I know umpteen sets for the straight sword. I do a few things with the spear. The Qigong that I do is got a lot of small joint articulation in it, mm-hmm. and spinal undulation, which you kind of don't want in more martial practices, mm-hmm. because it, you know, leaves you in a more vulnerable physical position. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think my feeling is that there, I have this sort of mid-sized curriculum for myself that I maintain. And if I had to, you know, suddenly hand that on to someone, it's doable, but it's also sufficiently rich so mm-hmm. that they're not missing giant elements. Mm-hmm. And I think also, like, the other thing with my experience of D.S. Ferrer, who has, like, taught me so much stuff, is he always says, oh, this is my core, but every time I see him every couple of years, yeah. it's slightly different, right? So, you know, like, I think I do this, I don't know if you do this, I have yeah. a file in my computer, which is, you know, there's a date and like what I think
yeah.
the curriculum should be. And then, you know, 6 months later, I've tweaked it a little yeah. bit and I've added something that I feel I need to work on or yeah. that I want to explore because I don't know much about it. Yeah.
No, I'm absolutely terrible for that. It's like I go one day, I go, right, I'm going to do this every day for the rest of my life because this is the answer.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, you're doing just such a different thing. You know, yeah. you're running a marathon or you're lifting weights or you're just mm-hmm. standing meditating. Or it's because you go, no, what I need to do now is this thing. It's just like the Chinese elements, just one overcoming the other in a constant cycle of, like, you know, it goes from, you know, old yin to young yang, and it's just
like, yeah.
So yeah.
The other one that I have experienced, and I almost have a sense of humor about this one now, is that when I'm making a performance, like directing and choreographing and facilitating, all I want to do is go back to like the playing of scales, which is basic martial training and sort of basic musical training for the voice. And as soon as I'm doing, you know, back in this, oh, I can finally go through and clean up all the foundations, and I'm doing, you know, have an opportunity for just training, you know, you get all that mental space and you start thinking, oh, I could make a performance about this, or oh, I'm really preoccupied with that. Maybe it would be so. You know, the grass is always greener. I'm now sort of used to that experience. And when it starts to happen, I will smile at myself a little bit more. Yeah. So I think that also plays in that, you know, as soon as you make a commitment, it allows you to see, you know, that's, you've taken a stand and you can see what's around you. And our acquisitive nature is like always going to lead us off somewhere.
Okay, you went a tiny bit glitchy there, so I think I'm gonna quit while we're ahead, and I'm just okay. gonna say that was a slightly shorter conversation than I would have liked, but at least it worked this time. It was yeah. such a pleasure. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. Take really good care, and we'll speak again soon.